Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hello and welcome to Your Book, the podcast for literary nosy Parkers. I'm your book inspector, Daisy Buchanan. My first novel, Insatiable, a love story for greedy girls, is out now in hardback. If you've been waiting for the paperback, it's coming in February with an exclusive special edition from Waterstones.com featuring never-before-seen content with an essay about writing, creativity and your erotic imagination, and a bonus secret saucy scene. And you get sprayed edges! Your book listeners can also pre-order my next novel, Careering, from Waterstones. It's coming in March. There's a limited number of signed copies available, and I hear they're selling fast. Now, on to today's guest, Lindsay Kelk. Lindsay is a superstar author. Her brilliant, bright rom-coms sell in their squillions, and it's not hard to see why. Her latest, On a Night Like This, is Spoonable Escapism. Sweeter and more mood-boosting than ice cream. Also, I've never met an ice cream that made me laugh so much as this did. She also hosts two podcasts, Full Coverage for Beauty Lovers and Tights and Fights for Wrestling Fans. She lives in Los Angeles, but we got to actually hang out with her on her UK tour. We talked about Virginia Andrews. We cried about Paula Dazinger. We called out James Herbert and his reductive male gaze. And we think we declared peace in the culture wars. And we laughed a lot. Lindsay used to work in publishing and you worked on the Mary Kate and Ashley books.
I did, for my sins.
How did those books work? Like, what sort of shape were they in when they got to you?
So by the time the fiction books were pretty much all done, but we also did brand extension books, which was, my team was the film and TV licensing. So any book that was related to film or a movie or a brand, so like a Noddy or a Dr. Seuss or my own personal nemesis, Fifi and the Flower Dots. Yeah, honestly, it just, a lot of my life went into that. We worked on those books. So the Mary-Kate and Ashley fiction books we brought in from the US, and then we would do sort of adjacent books that we created. We did a style guide, which was very fun. Mary-Kate and Ashley's style tips for tweens, which they very kindly sent us actual tips from the twins that were things like, add a vintage watch. And I'm like, it's for a 12-year-old. A Rolex feels a little bit out of their reach.
So you can see why they've gone on to, what's their brand called? Not, there's one that's got the James
Row.
In it.
There's the Row. James and the Row. And nice. I met them at an event. Yeah, I met them and they were merrily telling me that that was their next plan, was to launch fashion. And this was when they were still peak tween. And it was an event at, I think, the Soho Hotel. And one of them was dead excited because they'd just seen Ross from Friends. And I'm like, but you're so famous. And the other one was telling us how they were going to launch this fashion brand. And everyone in the room was like, sure, Jan, at them. And now we all are fools because they are massively famous fashion designers and super successful and really good.
And normally when someone says, I'm launching a fashion brand, you think, oh, great, you know, spangly T-shirt retails at $29.99 or whatever. Yeah. Good luck with that. But no, it's like proper, like, luxe.
Yeah, super high-end. They run a bunch of CFDA awards and everything. And this was sort of the mid-2000s. So it was peak Paris Hilton, Playboy, Juicy Couture type stuff.
No one would have blamed them if they wanted to have those, like, pube-skimming trousers.
It was the style at the time.
All right, so let's go back to those heady Y2K days, Lindsay. What were you reading then in those early aughts?
What was I reading? So I graduated in 2002 and had done English and basically didn't want to pick up a book for about 4 years because I'm like, this is so many books. So I had an early 2000s dip out. And then when I got my job in publishing, so I did a couple of jobs in PR first, I got very book clubby. I used to be a very snobby reader, and not even in a cool way. But I think because I grew up in a mining village where reading was not the best pastime that you could choose if you wanted to be popular. And I was a big fan of it, so hence I wasn't very popular. So I think they just went through a big phase of being told what you had to read. And then I morphed that into, I internalized a lot of the snobbery. So I was reading a lot of those 2000s book club books, like Curious Incident of the Dog in the Nighttime and Life of Pi and all that stuff. And then I was being very edgy and cool and reading my Bret Easton Ellis and my Donna Tartt on the side, being like, oh my God, I read The Secret History every year, which I still do. But yeah, I very much internalized what you should read rather than what I wanted to read.
Growing up, you were a big reader.
Huge, yes. So my mum taught me and my brother's older, she taught us to read very young before we went to school because she had very little faith in the school. We all went to the same school because it was a tiny mining village. So obviously, had the same teachers that my mum had before us. So she was like, let's get this taken care of. So I was reading really young and then I would just literally read anything. And I read like all the books that the school had, and I read all the books that the library had, and then I would just, if there was a book, it was in my hands, and just like really inappropriate books for a very young child.
Excellent. Tell me about those.
Yeah, the first one, actually, fun story, because I actually reread it recently because I have such a visceral memory of reading it. We were on holiday with my dad's family and my uncle had this James Herbert book, and it can't have been later than 1987 just because of who was on the holiday, and I remember it so clearly. And it was called The Magic Cottage. And I remember picking it up and reading it, and my mum saying, like, should she be reading this? Is this okay for her? And my uncle saying, like, oh, yeah, it's fine. There's nothing dodgy in it. It's nothing that dodgy. She won't get it anyway. So I can't have been more than 6 or 7.
Whoa.
Right? And all I could remember that there was a squirrel in it that dies and comes back to life. Spoiler alert for anyone planning to read The Magic Cottage, 1987. Spoiler alert. So I read it recently because I was like, you know what? I always tell that story about inappropriate books I read, so I should probably check it out. And like, it is, turns out, Uncle David, deeply inappropriate, but the squirrel was accurate.
And James Herbert, I mean, that's not your classic, you know, Lace or The Stud,
no,
or that,
no,
kind of,
it was dead weird. And I read a lot of Barbara Taylor Bradford because my mum loved Barbara Taylor Bradford, and I read all of Virginia Andrews before the age of 12.
And she comes up a lot on this, yeah, podcast. I think all the women I love were worship at the altar, the, yeah, mad, incestuous altar of V.C. Andrews.
And I started with the Heaven series and not the Flowers in the Attic series because that's what they had in the library when I went. And they let me take it out at like the age of 12. So what they were thinking, I do not know. But I was obsessed. I also reread a lot of those in lockdown, actually. Obsessed.
How? I mean, because lockdown, intense anyway, I imagine that universe is a very weird one to be in when you can't go outside.
Yeah, so strange because it is quite claustrophobic. And I read the Heaven series and I read the Flowers in the Attic series, and they are very claustrophobic, very intense. But all those characters are at some point locked in places.
So yeah, I don't have any memory of the Heaven series.
Oh,
which
my
one
god
is that?
It's so good. It's the Castiel family saga, and it is about a girl called Heaven who grows up in the Willies in the mountains. I think it's the Georgia mountains. And it's funny because my husband's family now is from sort of the North, South Carolina, Georgia area. I always like to be like, is this you? And it's not, because it's deeply offensive.
Is he from the Willies?
He's not from the Willies. He's from Spartanburg. So it's very upsetting.
I imagine Americans don't find the Willies as hilarious,
no,
as we
not
do.
Even a little bit. And they were always eating biscuits and gravy for breakfast. And as a kid, I'm like, what is wrong with these monsters? I'm like, that's the abuse. That's the child abuse. Biscuits and gravy, you savages. But yeah, she grows up with, she's the oldest child of this family, and the dad is really cruel to her, and then the stepmom, because her mom died in childbirth, and that's her curse, is she murdered her perfect mother by being born. And then the stepmother sort of hates her, but the granny and grandpa love her, and then obviously it just all falls apart in the style of Heaven, that Virginia Andrews books always do. And the dad sells off the kids. He just sells all the kids. And then you sort of follow their lives, and she finds out who she really is, who her real dad was, who her real mom was. Lots of tortured romances. But wow, it's a lot for a child. Your brain's not formed. It's not. No, it's not okay.
It's too spongy for us.
Yes.
Author to author, though, I'm struggling at the moment with getting my third novel going and the sort of, would this happen? Is this a bit preposterous? Is this a bit of a leap? Hearing about that plot, I'm like, no, not preposterous at all. Yeah. It's fine. No, very comforted by that.
She fell in love with her uncle and then he rode a horse into the sea. I mean, really, just give that a quick read and you will feel really good about any and all decisions you ever make plot-wise.
I love how eclectic and varied your reading journey has been. And what I love so much about your books and your latest book, On a Night Like This, is that it's so smart and light and sort of unapologetically fun and joyous. And there's not, you're like, it's really, I just feel like it's such a reader's book. And did you have a moment when you thought, I need to, all these sort of very like heavy, serious Oprah books, actually I can embrace the fun and I can embrace reading with this pure pleasure. Not that some of those books aren't pure pleasure.
No, but... no, I totally understand. it's the answer. I grew up as being like a really, I mean, we would say nerdy now, but in the 80s I was just unpopular. Like, we didn't have a cute tag for it. You were just a loser that read books. And I always wrote and I would always read. And I think I always thought you had to be very serious to be a writer and a reader. I didn't know you could read for fun, even though I was reading things like Virginia Andrews, which, you know, now it's like, oh, it's so soapy and pulpy. But when you're a teenager, it's incredibly serious business, because any reading endeavor as a teenager, I was reading Sweet Valley High and Sweet Dreams and Point Horrors, but it was like, I was the serious one just because it was a book. And then as I went through uni, like I say, my writing tutor actually gave me The Secret History because I was reading Bret Easton Ellis and he was like, I think you should read this instead. It's the same, but not. And a lady did it. And I was like, what? A woman can write this kind of book? And then when I actually wrote my first book, which was a rom-com called I Heart New York, like all of my friends, when I told them, were so shocked because they were like, oh, we just thought you would write something very serious and intellectual because you're so serious and intellectual. I'm like, not secretly, not, it turns out. And it took me a really, really long time to reconcile those two identities. And I think because there is such intellectual snobbery around, I mean everything, but around books and especially around women's writing and books that women might choose to write and read, it took me a really, really hard time to say it's actually okay for me to do this and not apologise for it and not be apologetic. And the new one, it was definitely because I wrote that during lockdown. Like it was a different feeling to it because it felt like for the first time I was allowed to just go balls to the wall, let's do something that makes me happy doing it and might make people happy reading it without having to feel like, well, it has to be good before I have to say, oh, I just write rom-coms. Don't look me in the eye. It's just rom-coms.
That's really interesting because, Lindsay, it is good. I'm not just saying this because you're here. There's a real, like, you're writing for smart readers in the way that I think, you know, someone like Nancy Mitford is so light and funny and unafraid of humour. I think it was really good to learn early that, you know, funny books were the most joyous thing, because I think I was 12 or 13 when I read American Psycho, and I remember that my parents had lots of like weird cool books in their spare room and lots of like those lovely really early sort of 80s Picador ones. And I remember I think I read some Laurie Moore short stories of not knowing what they were, and they like the feeling of them really stayed in my head. But I also read American Psycho and really took from it that, I mean, I think Bret Easton Ellis is phenomenal and can be phenomenal. And I sort of love that really creepy, chilly, cocainey, ironic detachment feeling. But also the misogyny in that was like exhilarating. It's like, okay, you've got to be a writer, you've got to hate women, you've got to hate everyone, you've got to write like nastiness for the sake of nastiness. And I think in the way that, like, you know, the teens of the 70s and 80s, you know, loved a video nasty.
Yes.
There's nothing more. It's like saying pasta isn't video nasty.
Cannibal Holocaust.
It did take me a little while to unlearn that you could love a reader. And I love that your books are seem so loving of their readers.
Thank you. It honestly did. It's ridiculous saying it out loud to me now. I live in America. I've done a lot of therapy. But it feels ridiculous to me to say it took me a really long time to learn that it was okay to write just something that was joyous and to not apologise and to not feel like I had to make it mean more than it means. And it still has meaning. I think if you've got nothing to say, why would you write? So there's always something to say in it. But yeah, you don't have to. I know a lot of people who feel like they've got to try and reach for some sort of critical acclaim or literary worthiness when what they do is amazing and they can't see it. And I think it is my favourite drum to beat, and all of my friends are listening and saying she's going to start down with the patriarchy. But it's like we've been told. I didn't make that up for myself that my books weren't good enough. I learned that. Someone told me that and I internalised it and I carried it around. And now I think I get messages from people that are like, oh, I was in hospital and my so-and-so was poorly and I took your book with me. And it took me a really long time to be able to like value that message and say, wow, that means something. That means as much as me being like, the secret history like changed my life. It's incredible. I'm, you know, partly Northern, so like can't accept any compliments of any kind ever. And partly just, yeah, was told that my work doesn't mean anything because I'm a woman and it's about women and it's about falling in love and that's stupid. When I'm like, what's more important? What do humans want more? So yeah, it makes me really happy whenever anyone says that they read it and it was an easy read that made them happy. Awesome. I worked really hard to make it an easy read that made you happy. So yay.
So maybe more recently, Lord knows we've all had, you know, all kinds of hard times. Are there books that have done that for you, especially in the sort of women's commercial fiction, books that have really uplifted you and taken you away?
I used to not be able to read when I was writing, and I was always writing. So I really struggled. And the last couple of years, I actually, like, I read more in the last 2 years than I've read in forever. And I read literally everything I could get my hands on. I get sent a lot of proofs, which is one of the best things ever about being an author. People just send you books. But I remember reading Gillian McAllister's latest, and I love her, and I love that.
Oh, what's that called?
Is it That Night? Because there's Vary McFarlane, obviously, who again is an incredible author who I love, and hers was last night, and Gillian's was That Night.
I do think Vary McFarlane is one of my favourites, and she's another one who writes. She's such a smart writer.
Oh, an absolute
you know, her
monster.
Universe is so full and so vivid, and she's writing for smart women. And I think that there are, again, it's the patriarchy and it's sexism, that, you know, we are legion. There are way more smart women than
people
want to
Vary's
cop onto.
Vary's work is exceptional. I think Vary is an incredible writer. I think what she's really good at is she does know exactly what she wants to say, and she's so good at striking that balance, and she's only coming into it more and more with every book. She just gets, it sounds so stupid, but she's more and more powerful in her work with every single book. And the fact that literally people aren't hurling her books at you in the street every time you leave your house is like offensive to me. They should be. She's that good. But I love her. I love her work.
She, you know, sells, you know, as you do in her tens of thousands of billions. Like, it's not like people don't know, but I'm like, people need to be talking about her more.
We don't talk about it because there is still a little bit of like, it's my secret shame. It's my guilty. And I don't believe in guilty pleasure. No. Like, if something gives you pleasure, why on earth would you feel guilty about it? Like, as long as it's, you know, consenting and legal, go nuts.
Hell, I was raised Catholic. Every single one of my pleasures is guilty.
Yeah. How dare you? How very dare you? But yeah, I did. I read a lot of commercial fiction. I actually, at the very beginning of lockdown, like, I went back and did a lot of rereading, and it was stuff I hadn't read. Like, I bought a load of the Sweet Valley High novels off eBay and was like, I'm just curious because these were so formative to me. I want to see what they're like. I'm like, oh, okay.
I'd love to go back into that. And you're talking about being a serious reader and that perfect, glossy Elizabeth and Jessica's universe. I would live there now.
I know. I mean, who wouldn't? I mean, I did move to LA. I tried. You know, I was like, where is my lavalier?
How much does that inform your decision? How much is that?
Not as much as you'd think. We very much don't live in Sweet Valley. Living in LA is really weird to read the books back. And like, they're just all going to the beach. No one goes to the beach. It's an hour away. Like, it's, everything's an hour away in LA. It's the traffic rumours are true. But it was really interesting to go back and read them. And you get that nostalgia, but also there's so much you don't remember about it. And you wonder how many of these slightly suspicious attitudes you internalised and carried around with you.
Oh, God, like, I'm sure there was like more than one occasion. Bruce Patman is like...
borderline rapist.
Probably more than borderline. And I don't quite know how this would work, that he'd be having sex with the wrong twin or trying to.
Yeah. Oh, there's one of the early books, if not the first book, I can't remember, but Jessica gets involved with the bad boy and he takes her to a bar and like strands her, and the police pick her up, and the policeman thinks it's Elizabeth and she lets him, and then Elizabeth is like shunned at school for slut shamed for like being found at a bar with this guy, and then Jessica eventually owns up to it. But it's all just utter slut shaming. And all she did was go out with this dude who was an actual monster. Like, and he was the one that was driving the car drunk and wouldn't let them out of the car and was trying to attack her. But the whole, all of the blame is on the twins the whole way through. And it's so scary that they were the attitudes we were given and told were acceptable in our fun teenagers' literature.
When you think about how many people were reading those books, and I'm not entirely sure of my Sweet Valley history and the dates, but I'm thinking about, I guess, around about the AIDS crisis and all things making us super, super, super anxious about having sex in a happy and relaxed manner.
Well, and they're very, I mean, they're very chaste books, and anyone who does have sex is shunned, and it's very much like horror movie rules where it's like, well, if you had sex, you're gonna die. They don't die in Sweet Valley, but they are shunned or reformed. So you either have to sort of be redeemed by the good twin. You know, it's usually Elizabeth takes in the slutty one and makes it her friend, and you're like, oh my God, oh my God.
This is a very reductive question, but did you want to be Elizabeth or Jessica?
I very much wanted to be Jessica because I was absolutely an Elizabeth.
Same.
Yeah, it was. I felt very closely attached to those books. So they were fun to go back and read, but like I read those, like I said, I read Virginia Andrews again. I actually went back and read all of the Suki Sackhouse novels, the True Blood series.
Wow. Did you read them before they were on TV?
I read them when they were on TV, when the TV was announced, because I grew up in the 90s, so like, yes, please, vampires, all of them, every time.
Are you a Twilight person?
Yes-ish. I was a Buffy person. Because I am 41, so I was a Buffy person. But then I was working in children's publishing when Twilight came out, so I, she says in inverted commas, had to read it.
I was working at Bliss magazine, again.
It was a dream. Yeah, so you had to, and I remember just...
To learn to do my Twilight.
It was such a weird thing, because I have such a massive amount of respect for anything that is that beloved by teenagers. And obviously then being, I was very much deep in my, I'm just reading Michael Cunningham, so I'm afraid I can't enjoy this. But I had such respect for how it sees into the soul of a teenage girl. Mm. When you are, and a lot of romance, not even just teenage girls, but like Bella is just an ordinary girl. And then this eternal being chooses you. What do you want more as a teenager? What do you want more than to be chosen and seen and acknowledged as special? And it's like, it is genius in its simplicity. It really is.
I absolutely go back and forth on this. And I think that when one is a Buffy fan, and Buffy is such a brilliant, you know, fierce, fiery, like, ass kicker, and she's so inspiring, and she's like a strong woman. And then you're like, oh, Bella, she's such a drip. But yeah, when I was, you know, a teenage girl, I felt like a drip. Ooh. There's nothing, you know, again, it's like wanting to be Jessica and being Elizabeth. There's nothing I would have liked more than to be a Buffy. But I think if I had been an age-appropriate reader of Twilight, I would have felt really seen. And I think the genius Bella is written in a very deliberate way where sort of stuff happens to her and she could be anyone, down to like she's never really physically described. I think it's like this, you know, she's got sort of her hair is sort of lovely and but it's all like vague, so anyone can be in that gap.
Yes, and absolutely, she's very often described by others, and she's very reactive. Everything happens to Bella. Like the only choice she really makes, I think, is, I mean, they say at the beginning when she's like, I'm going to choose to offer up my life in service of someone I love, and I never thought about it, I genuinely think that's such a good beginning, like, literally never gave much thought about how I would die, but to die in the place of someone I love seems like a good reason, and you're like, oh my God, I'm in. If I'd been 14, you would have torn that book out of my cold, dead hands, like, there would have been no way. But yeah, she's such a great cipher for you to just project yourself onto. And yeah, it's that total thing, isn't it, where this eternal stud picked you out of, he's lived 200 years and waited for you this whole time. And then a hot werewolf fancies you as well. So like, rock and roll, do it, Bella. Go nuts. So
something I'm curious about is whether there's much of a difference that you notice living in America and in Los Angeles in particular, the sort of general, like, the attitude to reading and how people read and what people read and where they get their books, because I'm imagining it being a little more extreme.
Yes. Well, I lived in New York before I lived in LA as well, and I moved to New York in 2009, so it was, I just published it here when I moved there, and I would go on endless dates with gentlemen from Brooklyn, and they would say, I'm a writer. I'd be like, oh my God, I'm a writer. And then they would immediately shit all over what I did. And I'd be like, oh,
I bet
okay.
They had a book published either.
No, they had like 10 unfinished manuscripts in their bottom drawer and they were sat in a coffee shop working on their blog. And I'm like, fair play to you. You're doing it. That is you doing it. And I'm doing it too in a different way. But it, New York was rife with intellectual snobbery in a way that the country can be. I mean, we'd be here all day if we want to talk about anti-intellectualism in America, like anti-intellectualism with Lindsay Gelt.
Yeah,
I mean, Jesus. But yeah, it was really hard. And a lot of my being down on what I did was the fact that as soon as I was published, I'd left the UK. So I never really saw my books doing well. I wasn't really aware of it. And I lived in America where they weren't out yet and where people just made fun. Like, they would be like, oh my God, like that's hilarious that that's what you've chosen to do. And I was like, is it? I thought it was pretty great. I thought it was pretty cool. But then when I moved to LA, because you live in New York and you tell people you're a writer and they say, oh my God, what have you are you published? What have you published? Who is your publisher? You move to LA and you say, I'm a writer. And they say, what show? Because they just immediately assume you're in showbiz. No one thinks book. And there's actually like quite a big author community in LA. And a lot of people left New York and moved to LA. And especially romance, and I'm very much classed as a romance author in America, whereas here we have sort of commercial women's fiction, yeah, which doesn't really exist there. And it sort of straddles both worlds.
Because I suppose here as well, there is that, you know, and I find it frustrating. Like, well, where does your book go in the bookshop?
I'm
like, yes. A window! Yes. What am I saying? No,
on a shelf.
But I think that having been to the, you know, the mega stores, and, you know, I know Barnes and Noble sort of still exists, and I know it's very different now, but there is that weird, like, just the breadth of it and the volume and the number of books they sort of have to categorise.
No, absolutely. And that's one of the reasons everything has to be so carefully categorised there. And romance is like massively on the up, massive resurgence in romance. It's an amazing community. I've made so many new friends over the last couple of years because people really rallied around, and it is women looking after women, and it's been amazing to see. But there's also a part of it where it's not reductive, because it's, I don't think it's reductive if it's done out of love, but there is a whole thing where it's like, what tropes are in this book, which boxes are ticked. So is it a friends to lovers? Is it an enemies to lovers? Is there, it's just one bed? Is it forced together? Like, is it forbidden love? Is it second time around? And like, there is an industry sort of standard where you've got to hit tropes to fit into boxes to sell. And I think part of that is just what's been happening in the world the last couple of years. People want to know. A romance novel to a romance reader is the same as going to see a Marvel movie or a James Bond movie. It's like, you want the catharsis. You want to know what you're getting out of it at the end. You want to know James Bond's going to save the world. You want to know the Avengers are going to defeat thick purple daddy Thanos, you know. It's like, it's, you know, you want to have that moment in the middle where you're like, oh, how is it going to work out? But I want to know I'm coming out of it satisfied and happy, and I'm not going to feel worse than I went in. Which obviously I love an ambiguous ending. I love an ambiguous ending, but that's not what people have come for in a rom-com. And if I went to a rom-com with an ambiguous ending, I would probably be a little bit upset at the moment. So it is interesting. But yeah, LA is really interesting. People are way more impressed in LA when you tell them that you write books, because they just don't see it.
That gladdens my heart, at least. I had two questions for you. And I guess one was about any romance authors in particular that you have discovered living over there that maybe here we don't know about, that we should know about. And then I also want to know, saying this before I forget, about your favourite ambiguous endings.
I can't remember anything about anything I've ever read. I just read a book called The X-Hex, which I think is Erin Sterling is the author's name. She writes under two different names because she writes different kinds of books. And obviously in America, you can only have one type of book with one name on it because it will confuse people, me here, where I can't remember. But yeah, it was a rom-com called The X-Hex that came out around Halloween. It was Halloween sort of themed in that it was vaguely witchy. It's not vaguely witchy, it is witchy, but it's so fun. And it was the first rom-com, American rom-com in particular, that I'd read in a minute. It was just genuinely, genuinely, like, laugh out loud, could not put it down. And there's a lot of good romance coming out of the States right now. Like Emily Henry, who wrote Beach Read and You and Me on Vacation. I think she's amazing. K.M. Jackson, Quanah Jackson, her new book, How to Marry Keanu Reeves in 90 Days, just came out, which obviously, like, as you can tell from the title, super fun. You've got Sarah McLean writing Regency romances, are super feminist, super, super fun. But The X-Hex genuinely... like, I could not put it down. It was so funny and smart and feminist. It ticked every box. Super hot. like genuinely sexy. I was like, oh, feel a little bit like I want to go in the other room and finish this. It just shouldn't be read in polite company. But it was in a very tasteful, fun way. It wasn't, in the US, they love using the word smut. They love smut. Like, they will literally go on Bookstagram and people will rate smut levels. And I'm from a world where smut is a bad word. But smut is like a grading. They'll say spice or smut in the romance community. And I am zero spice or smut. My books are zero smut, and it's deeply disappointing for a lot of people.
I don't know. I'm trying to think that there's a hint of, you know.
It's light kissing. There's light kissing and some over
mild
the
peril, light kissing.
Yeah, yeah, mild peril, light kissing, over the trouser touching. That's
potential for
yes.
smut, at least. But I love it. Sounds as though there are people who are subverting those expectations and taking something that maybe seems quite rigid and working out how to do it stealthily in their own terms.
Yeah, it's been nice to see. It's been really nice to see, and especially to see women coming together to just say, hey, let's all support each other. And everyone quotes for everyone now. Everyone promotes everyone. Everyone will like say, hey, read this, it's great. There's not, there very much used to be an element of like, well, she's, you know, it was pie. It's like, there's limited pie and I need the pie. But now it's like, hey, we'll just make more pie. Let's just all have pie. There's loads of pie. And it's a nice time to be doing it. I've been doing it for a while and it's not always been like that.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role. Like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
We'll be back with Lindsay soon, but now it's time for my Steal of the Week. I've chosen The Female Chef, Stories and Recipes from 31 Women Redefining the British Food Scene by Claire Finney and Liz Seabrook. This is heaven. It's the sort of cookbook that can be read as a novel. It's inspiring, fierce and comforting. Romy Gill's dull recipe is worth the price of admission alone, but the interviews with brilliant women are brilliant. In the words of Angela Hartnett, my aunt always says women run everything in a way, they just don't go on about it. The Female Chef is published by Hoxton Mini Press, a publisher I adore, and it's out now. And also, this would make an excellent Christmas present. Now, back to Lindsay.
I really, really notice it with you on social media and what a generous cheerleader you are. And when you talk about books, I always want to
I really love books. I really love books. And I just think for so long, I only read what I thought I should read. And I didn't dare read what I thought someone would judge, and it makes me mad that I cost myself so many amazing books. And like, I do love all kinds of books. Like, there's a book out this year, Megan Abbott, who wrote Dare Me, I think it's probably her most famous book, but her new book, The Turnout, it's like a literary thriller, but very literary. I loved it. Like, I couldn't put it down. I loved it so much. But then the next book I read after that was Andy J. Christopher's Hot Under His Collar, which was like a very sexy Fleabag-inspired Catholic priest. So, you know, pick that one up. Girl who falls in love with a Catholic priest. And I'm like, you can read both and you're not stupid. You're not less than. You're allowed to enjoy things. Imagine if you only ate kale because it's good for you. You know, like, you're allowed to do all of the things. And I do try and shout it from the rooftops because I didn't hear it said to me.
Yeah.
So I just want to say it to other people.
I really, really hope that that is one of our lessons. I think it's far too soon to, you know, work out what we have learned over the last 18 months.
Yeah.
But I think that, you know, prioritise pleasure is self-esteem says.
Right? Yeah. No, I've spent a lot of money on therapy, as I say. I moved to America, they made me. but it was just like, let my money have been spent for your use. You know, like, just don't do something that you don't want to do. I can't not finish a book. Like, I cannot not finish. I have to read all the way through. And I'm trying really hard to get to a place where I can not finish. But I also feel rude. I'm like, I feel like they're going to know. I'm like, someone's going to know that I didn't finish it. And then I'm incredibly rude.
What it's like to show up and sit at your desk and do the work. And you know that every time a book comes in the post, you're like, I know how much of a person's life this represents.
Oh, this is the thing. And it's the question that I'm asked the most at events. It's like, how long does it take? Or how do you write? And I was like, you just have to sit there and do it. And there is no magic. There's no magic trick. There is no advice I can give you as to how I do it and how you should do it. Everyone does it differently. But ultimately, everyone sits at a desk and they write, or on a settee, like me, which is why I've got a bad back. But it's like everyone just sits with a laptop and writes a book. And there's no way around it. There's no trick. So the hours that have gone into that person's work, how dare I not finish it, you know?
Do you think that's the people who come to your events and want to ask and want to find out, you know, about you and your books and your world, that it is the process that eludes them? Are they all frustrated, aspiring writers? Like, there must be some alternative to the sitting.
Yeah, I think, well, I also think social media has been so interesting because I first published 12 years ago and we weren't where we are with social media at all. And I love social media because I write. So I'm on my own a lot of the day, like a lot of hours. I'm just sat on my own with a laptop. So I love to check in. I always call it like my work friends, like my Twitter friends are my work friends because I can't go to the kitchen and make a cup of tea and catch up on the gossip. So I'll just pop on Twitter and check out what's happening.
It's a water cooler.
Yes,
there are unwitting colleagues.
Exactly. I was like, what's going on? Everyone knows. Gossip, gossip, gossip. Let's talk about Succession. So that's sort of where I checked in with social media. But I think, especially in the UK, because I lived in New York and then LA, when social media blew up and when my books came out, I think some people are mistaken into thinking my life is somehow quite glamorous. I'm laughing because it's not.
It does seem glamorous.
It does seem that, but it's just because the sun is out and the sun is not my friend. So that's no good to me. I am northern. I am of northern stock. I don't see the sun. But I totally get it. And I do think there are some people who think, some people must think my writing process is somehow therefore more glamorous than it, just me in my pyjamas telling my cat to get off my laptop.
They sort of on daytime telly, they're imagining a day in the life of Joan Collins and then she throws her diamond encrusted credit cards at the servants.
Yes, exactly. This is it. I'm like, maybe I'll pop to Barney's and buy a diamond encrusted pot of creme de la mer and then I'll come home and like write four words with my pointer fingers and move on. I'm like, no, I'm sat until like 2 o'clock in the morning screaming at Word being like, why have we only written four sentences today? It's not pretty. It's never pretty.
Oh God, I'm having a horrible, horrible moment of realisation, enlightenment, where I think about the worst thing I do. And it's not even like I'm going and browsing on Net-a-Porter like a glamorous person. I'm going on the outnet looking for things that, you know, the cheaper end of what they sell that will make me feel like the glamorous writer person I would like to be.
Every time, and I would say it's towards the end of a first draft, the packages start to arrive. And then they all have to go back because that is how, sometimes it's how you get through, right? You're having a horrible day of writing, you're like, maybe I'll just buy 17 things from ASOS. And then they arrive and you hate yourself and they all have to go back. But there is that minute where you're like, this is how we did it today, kids. For anyone who was wondering. But yeah, it's not cute. It is my husband asking if I've showered.
King does that also.
I'm positive he's got an account on boohoo.com. You know? He's like, he wants the Love Island outfits. He's obviously a big fan.
Am I right in thinking, you talked a bit about vampires. Do you have any interest in sort of horror, Stephen King? And
not really. I think that James Herbert experience really knocked me on the head as a kid. I used to read a lot of teen horror. Like I read all the point horrors.
Yes,
I was obsessed. And then I didn't really follow it through. I think reading the James Herbert again recently, because it is the 80s, I don't know anything about James Herbert as a human. I don't know the whole thing. But reading it, it so struck me that it is so, I don't want to say misogynistic, because I don't know that some of it definitely is. He refers to a woman as a bull dyke more than one time. I'm like, oh, we don't do that now, sir. We don't do that.
I'm just thinking how interesting it is. And I absolutely sort of concur and know what you mean. And you can get into Foucault and Derrida and intention. Yeah. But woman to woman, you're like, oh, I don't know if I can call this misogynistic. No, this I felt that, but that's only my opinion. As a woman, like, oh my God, Lindsay, like, yes.
And if nothing else, it's
screw
just
you, James Herbert.
Very heavily male gaze. Mm. And it was just like the main character that carries, that brings you through the book is a man. Oh, fair enough. But you're sort of led to believe that his partner is this sort of, she's a conduit for magic. So they move to the magic cottage and they talk about this woman who lived there before, who was sort of the guardian of the magic of the cottage. And you're led to believe this woman is going to be the new guardian of it. And then at the end, it's like, but surprise, it was me. And she was just supposed to get me there. And all, I was reading it, I was like, oh, you see what you've done there, James, is... And all the way through, the male, there's one point where he's talking about his girlfriend walking out into the garden in her little short shorts, and there's a vicar come round to see them, and he's like, and I can see the vicar appreciating her slender velvety legs, because even though he's a man of the cloth, he's just human. I'm like, that is your fucking girlfriend? Oh. Like, but he's reducing women to objects all the way. So I'm like, yeah, it's not misogynistic, but it is. But it's just so heavily male gaze. Every woman is presented in terms of her attractiveness to him. And what whether or not he can bang her. And then sort of, you know, the lesbian character saves the day at one point, and he's sort of like, oh, good on Val, hey? You know, in her sensible brogues. And you're like, oh, my God.
Who knew?
Yeah, who knew?
I thought you were of absolutely no use to me, woman-wise, but you've proved me wrong.
It was, yeah, because she's his girlfriend's agent, so that's why she's tolerated. But he's like, she's just a 20%er. She's a 20%er. I'm like, no, she literally, like, keeps your partner in work. So shut your mouth, maybe, fella. You write, you're a session musician for Phil Collins. Like, that's his job in the book. He's a session musician for Phil Collins. And it's like, he goes to London to lay down some tracks with Phil, and I was dying with laughter reading
does
it.
Does Phil Collins know? Are you allowed to?
Oh, I hope so. I massively hope Phil got wind of this in 1987 and was like, this is spot on. And then he faxed his wife to divorce her. Like, I just feel like there is a certain connection between the two themes that Phil probably thought it's a sort of really sound book.
My kind of book. Were there any books, I think, Virginia Andrews aside, yeah, perhaps for this, where you, the first time you were aware of a sense of like a female gaze and, you know, that
honestly,
women could be in charge?
I'm sounding like I stopped reading in 1997, and I might have. But I read a lot of Paula Danziger and a lot of Judy Blume.
I feel like Paula Danziger. We never talk, well, we do sometimes,
obsessed.
But I think
every
she's phenomenal and so dark and so real, and
yeah,
I don't think she gets anything like her snaps.
Because I preferred her to Judy Blume, like, for no real reason that I could put my finger on, because I haven't looked back why. But Herbert Remember Me to Herald Square was like, that was the beginning of my love affair with New York. And, you know, that led to me visiting New York in my 20s, which led to me writing about New York, which led to me moving to New York. And I still have my original copy of Remember Me to Herald Square, and I can tell you the plot of that story from beginning to end. I loved it so much. And it's Remember Me to Herald Square, sorry, because the real place is Herald Square, and the character in the book always misheard it as Harold and thought it was a person, but it's Herald. She always said Harold. But there was a book, This Place Has No Atmosphere, where this family moves to the moon, which is amazing. And oh my God, it's
incredible.
So good. And the pistachio prescription, I remember loving. Was it There's a Bat in Bunk 5? I think that's Paula Danziger,
yes,
as well. And my parents got divorced, and she wrote about things like that. And in the 80s, it was still very shameful. Yeah. We were still like, don't tell kids at school that your dad's like, you know, it was like 1989, and I'm 8, and I don't know what to do with this information. So having those books sort of in the late 80s, early 90s, it was massive for me. And they were just by a woman for, and I'm, you know, I'm sure they gave comfort to all kinds of people, but for me it felt like by a woman for a woman.
Well, I think for me it was The Cat Ate My Gymsuit.
Oh,
and
yes,
I was a tubby girl at school.
Same.
And there wasn't, and I really felt like the only one, and
yeah,
I was really like bullied quite, you know, cruelly and violently. But I sort of, because I was so little, I didn't really understand that it wasn't right what was happening, and no one really seemed interested in sort of presenting it, and I thought it's my lot to do it. And I think she was an older character, but to have someone like her as a heroine and to write about what it felt like to inhabit her body, and that she had sort of hopes and dreams, and she had a teacher who saw her, it really, sorry, I'm going to cry, emotional.
I would give you a hug, but
we do not hug in these times.
No, how dare we feel feelings.
But no, I've not read it for a long time, probably since then, but I just remember really being, you know, I felt like I'd been skinned, yeah. But in a nice way. Like, I cannot believe this woman doesn't know me, but does know me.
Yeah, no, I know. But that's, to me, is why I write what I write now, is, like, I want someone to see themselves. Like, it is so incredibly powerful, like, to be...
Sorry.
No, I get
I
it.
I don't make a habit of it.
It's so powerful to be seen. And that's... The thought that anyone would dismiss something like Paula Danziger just because it's just a teeny rom-com or a teeny comedy, and it's like, no, it made a difference to your life. And that was me growing up. And I always wanted to write YA. I always assumed I would write YA because they were the books.
Yeah.
I'm not going to cry. I am going to cry. I was bullied and I had big, thick glasses and I was a heavy set kid, broad across the beam, as my thoughtful mother, who is not with us anymore, who can't defend herself, but, like, my mum was really petite and very, very pretty and very, very popular and all those things, and I wasn't. And I knew it, you know? It's like, so you were bullied at school and then you were made aware that you might not quite be what you were expected to be at home.
Yeah.
And it was the same thing. Those books, for me, were the place where I could perhaps see that there was a place for me to fit when I didn't feel like there was. And that's, I guess, ultimately, that's what I'm trying to do, is say, you might not think you fit into a place this second, but you do. Like, you do, everyone does. But to find a place to be seen and to be acknowledged, I just think it's so hard, and books can do that for you.
Well, I mean, I think on a night like this, it's the most, like, beautiful, uplifting romance, and I love the sort of the, because it is that, it's what everyone wants, where it's, it starts in a place that is real and a place you can recognise straight away, and it takes you to somewhere fabulous and glittering and spectacular where you want to visit. But as well as the romantic relationship and the exciting relationship, there's also a really, you know, like, awful relationship, and it's awful in a really, like, tangible and recognisable way. And it's not dramatically bad, but it is so bad, and I don't want to give too much away. And I was just thinking about the many, many women who hopefully will feel like, oh, this is what, you know, my life, and these things that I feel like I should just put up with and not ask for too much and not complain about. You know, maybe they will change things, and I hope they do. Maybe they will just feel seen and they will have a bit of a glove, and maybe that's, that moment of comfort is enough. But it made me think, and I hope you think this is a compliment, of one of my favourite Marion Keys. Who am I kidding? They're all my favourite.
All of them.
Think all the time about Last Chance Saloon, and there's that super serious, really, you know, sad cancer story at its heart, but also the brilliantly observed and brutal and awful of it, Tara and her terrible boyfriend Thomas. And I think Marion always comes back to these really intensely touching and moving and devastating, the things that women can do to cope, and our addictions. And I know we laugh about ordering 19 things
that's
from ASOS. And the,
you know, and when we're sad, we add to cart. That's what we do.
Favorite meme. But also, it's a trope, isn't it? Of, I think, older, there are certain bits of, like, commercial women's fiction. And again, it's like, and I think Helen Fielding is a truly gifted and masterful writer, and I think she was holding up a mirror to something and writing with great wit and great thought. But people criticize Bridget, oh, she's just obsessed with her weight, and that's not very feminist.
Yeah, that's now. And I read that book when I read Bridget Jones when I was about 16-17, and my stepmom, again, all of my family weren't massive readers, but everyone had a few books squirreled away. Like, my granddad had this massive bookcase of Geoffrey Archer's, which I quickly realized weren't for me, but then he had, like, Tom Stoppard's and stuff, which I did read, didn't get them, but I knew they were hilarious. And then, like, my mum had her Barbara Taylor Bradford's, and my stepmom had Bridget Jones. And I remember I was staying there, and I found it because I was wandering around my dad's house, as you do. And I stayed up all night to read it, and I nicked it. Apologies, Deb. I still got it. Like, I still got her paperback copy. Yeah. And it was the original paperback with the silhouette of the girl smoking, the woman smoking, Bridget. And I had never seen anything like it. And as 17, about to go out into the world. But I read that, and then I read Watermelon by Marion Keyes, like, at the same sort of time. And I remember lines of Watermelon, like, I can quote very specific lines from it, because I didn't know that those books existed and could exist. And it was amazing.
You were allowed to write those books.
Yeah, because I was still reading books that they gave me at school that I had to read and books at the library that they had. You know, and my library, it was a very small village library. The choices were very limited. I read everything they had, and they didn't have any of these very new current books, or at least I wasn't getting them because they were always out. I don't know. But those two books, Watermelon and Bridget Jones's Diary, I was like, what? We can do this? And then a few years later, it was Devil Wears Prada that I didn't know. I didn't know you could do this. Because then I was coming out of uni and I was chock full of, yeah, like Kurt Vonnegut and Bloody Catcher in the Bloody Rye and Great Gatsby up to the tits, you know? So I was like, only these books. I think you'll find I'm reading all of the queer theory canon now. And they were great books and I learned a lot. Like Sound of the Fury every morning, noon and night. But then suddenly they were like, no, you can just read books that are about life now and can tell you something.
I reread Watermelon recently and I was really surprised at how fresh it feels and how it's so, you know, stylistically such a sort of powerful comic novel. And I've learned so much about writing from it, just from like the rhythm that she writes with. Yeah. And you can really hear the thought and care.
Yes.
And the way, and it's because you can read it in so many ways, and you're not the, oh, this is really like a laborious, but it's, I think you can tell the skill and the craft and the voice.
Yeah.
And so that's what makes it such a pleasure to read. But
yeah.
I mean, I think that Bridget Jones was, because all we know, she's obsessed with the weight and getting a man.
But we were told to be, so we were.
I think I would have been, again, it's that, you know, my sort of antidote to American Psycho, that kind of age, 12, 13-ish. I'm 36, so sort of, I don't think I got to read it, like, when it came out. I think I'd read the odd column in The Independent, which my granny got, and I thought, this is a newspaper? I thought newspapers were very boring. And then I think I got out of the library, possibly. But just the idea that she's got a London life and a career, and sure, Perpetua is awful, but I love the idea of, like, have my own flat and a cool job and go out and get drunk with these like glamorous pals.
Yeah, your chosen family. It was like one of the first examples I saw of chosen urban family.
Yes.
That was like, what? I can do
and
this?
Sort of living, you know, being a family and having a family. I'm not, I think, you know, choose your choice if you want to sort of go and have children and have a family. And I know that she, you know, yearns for it in one way, and I think that's a wonderful thing to do. But also, it was the first alternative I was offered. And the sort of, I think lots of the story, and even Randall the Dickens and Austen, and I adore Jane Austen, and I knew you had to get married and have a family, but the thrill, and I think as a feminist writer, she does not get enough credit for that.
No,
for
truly
painting this, a world where women had not been in the workforce for that long.
No, and I think we've got a really, I mean, I'm really pleased that things are being revisited now and we're re-establishing, re-evaluating, and things are getting lifted up and things are being questioned, and it's great. But I have a lot of people, whenever I talk about Bridget, people say the exact same thing to me, like, oh, but she was just obsessed with her weight and getting a man. And I think, but there is a contextual thing with Bridget, where at the time it was strikingly feminist because she was only concerned with what she wanted.
Yeah.
And she was allowed to be. And that mirror I'd never seen it held up before. And like you, like, I'd read a ton of Austen, I read the Brontes, like Wuthering Heights and Jane Eyre, two of my favourite novels of all time. And you look at Jane Eyre and I'm like, there's you can read Jane Eyre, and I know it's obviously Pride and Prejudice, but you can read Jane Eyre and see a lot of Bridget of the time. And I think, yeah, Bridget, props to Bridget. When also just the writing is good. Whenever I'm stuck, if I'm having a bad time and I've forgotten how to write a book, which is sort of every other day, I'll pick up Bridget and read a few pages of Bridget and be like, oh yeah, comedy. I remember you.
Skipping back to Marion, like a mad shill, but I just think about how there's so much I've read, and I have a special fondness for any women's commercial fiction written in the mid to late 90s.
Yep.
I would quite like to cosplay the 90s in the way that other people cosplay medieval times.
The trope, they're all doing it.
Yay!
They're all doing it. I went in H&M the other day and it looked like Clockhouse. I tell you, it looked like 1994 Clockhouse, and I was very concerned and
it's
very British.
Not other 36-year-old women, though, is it? It's 16-year-olds who weren't
born. It's unfortunately 16-year-olds, and I was very uncomfortable and clearly was not meant to be there. Like, that's how I felt right away. They were all doing TikToks in the middle of H&M.
Like, oh, blimey.
Nana felt quite out of
place. Those books were all very much like, oh, he didn't call me, so I'm going to eat this whole tub of Haagen-Dazs.
Yeah.
And Marion, I think, takes, in general, their addictions and obsessions, and food especially, and writes about being crippled by it. And there's in, I think, How to Be a Woman, there's something Kat Moran says, which I think about constantly, about how, and I wish I could remember how she phrased it, but that if you're a woman and if you are either a formal carer or you've just got lots of people around you to look after independently, you cannot go and like bang a load of heroin or knock back a bottle of whiskey. You can eat packets of biscuits at a time, and if you're unhappy and no one is listening to you, and like food is something that is used to torture women and it's a silencer and it's a really easy way of keeping us in check. And I think that the writers who write about that, and again, it's a really subversive thing to do, and you think, oh, chick lit trope
came up in Grown Ups again, which I loved, and I read that with new eyes, because I've had disordered eating and I've had issues with it my whole life, and I remember seeing, because you just didn't, you weren't allowed to talk about it. Food either had to be something that you were very carefree about, or you just didn't touch it. You're not allowed to just have an ordinary relationship where you're neutral about food, and that's new and I love it. But I remember when I lived in Brooklyn, there was a comedian, she's an actress now, she's in like Jenny Slate, she's an amazing actress, doing
so well. Jenny Slate.
Yeah, so we were in Brooklyn at the same time and we would always go and see her comedy show, and she had a bit that was about, she was on her way back from an audition, or she was on her way to an audition, and she saw this toddler in a Starbucks or a coffee shop with a muffin, and she's like, this little girl was just picking at a muffin and playing with it and messing around with it, and she was like, and I just sat staring at her like, you eat that fucking muffin. She was like, do you know how, she was like, you have like a minimum number of years before you can no longer eat that muffin. She's like, you eat that muffin for me, I want to see every mouthful of that muffin go to. And I remember I'd never heard it said and never had it acknowledged. It was maybe 2009 2010. I remember being like, yeah, I daren't eat a muffin in public, because what if people think, oh, look at that big fat bitch eating a muffin, you know? And I was like, oh my god, what is wrong with me? And then when you read something like Marion where that is acknowledged, and it's not dismissed out of hand, because we've moved on from that now. You can totally have a muffin if you want one. It's like, no, you can't move on from it until you've addressed it. And Marion addresses those things with such care and honesty and vulnerability that, it's being seen. It's being seen. And I don't think anyone does what Marion does as well as Marion, which, you know, makes sense. But she's just such a gift to us. Like, everything she does has... there's a point to it. There's a meaning to it.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Did you ever read or come across a book called Elegance by a writer called Kathleen Tesoro?
Yes, I have it, and I haven't read it. It's on my never-ending TBR.
I think it came out in like the year 2000, and I think I was given it as a Christmas present when I was a teenager.
It's one of my friend's favourite books.
Oh, really?
And she gave it to me, and I have that, and she gave me that very recently, and Rodden by Curtis Sittenfeld, who I love, Curtis Sittenfeld, and I haven't read either of them yet. But yes.
Oh my god, well, Elegance is, I've reread it many times, and again, I'm really surprised at how it lives. And again, it feels, it's written so beautifully, and it's so funny, and it's very, it's sort of seductively, you're pulled into that universe straight away. But it does go from her, again, quite playfully talking about changing, and it's that it starts in a marriage, and not to do too much of a spoiler, you learn quite early that her husband is gay, and he's a self-hating gay man. He doesn't want to acknowledge who he is, and he's been trying to run from it. And she's been trapped in this unhappy reality and decides that changes must be made. And the theme of the book is this. It's like an old 1950s style guide she finds in a charity shop called Elegance. And she's completely lost herself and doesn't know who she is or how to be or how to feel good. And it's sort of her, I suppose, like a spiritual and aesthetic journey. But it goes from her with her flatmate. And her flatmate is like, you know, she talks about her and says, like, you know, she's thin and she can eat anything and I hate her. And she's just bought cake and she's asking me if she wants cake and I'm just having a black coffee and I want to punch her in the face. And that feels very sort of, you know, funny and relatable. And then it goes to, there's a scene at night where she's up and it's 3 o'clock in the morning and she's binge eating these like horrible sugar cookies. And she's like, these taste awful and they've gone off and I don't know, they're not even mine and I don't know what I'm doing to myself. And then that same flatmate who the biscuits belong to comes down and she's like, what are you doing, these are stale. And she's like, I'm so sorry, I ate your cookies. And she's like, no, it's not about that, it's about I'm worried about you
through food. It's fascinating to me what we do and what we don't talk about. And then that again, it's how women's fiction It's so, even, I mean, I came in at the end of the 2000s when chiclet was still a term widely used, and now people are like, oh, is it okay if I say chiclet? Is that derogatory? I'm like, well, it's only derogatory if you say it in a derogatory sense. I don't care. Call it whatever you want to call it. I just write books, so I don't know. But I think so often, as soon as you put women's in front of it, it's less than to certain people, and not even just men, like to a lot of people, you know, be like, oh, I don't read. I've got friends in LA, friends in America, she's like, oh, I don't really read women's fiction. And I'm like, oh, I'm sorry. Yeah, I know. I'm like, oh, I'm sorry. Did I bring ovaries to this table? Do I identify as a woman? It's not, I'm like, what the fuck? It's nuts. And you don't have to have ovaries to have a woman. I am going to put this out there. Don't have to have ovaries to be a woman. And if you identify as a woman, you're a woman. You can come to my house. Everything's fine. Family members who like don't read my books or haven't read my books are like, oh, it's not my cup of tea. I'm like, you've never read it.
How would you
like
know?
You've never read it. And if it's not, that's fine. I'm like, it's just very weird to me. I'm like, I love Kazuo Ishiguro, and I love Marion Keyes, and I love the XX, and I love Wuthering Heights. You know, like it, all things to all people. Like,
you
why
sound
not?
Like your reading has a broad beam, just, and I love that. But
it's true. A broad beam of reading.
Very, very sadly, I just want to talk to you all day long, but I think we're coming close, yes, close to the end. So I was wondering if there are any books, the last book where you were a little bit trepidatious and thought, I'm not absolutely sure this is my cup of tea, and then thought, wow, this is great.
The Turnout by Megan Abbott, which I mentioned. So my husband is a TV editor, and he worked on Dare Me, and he worked with Megan. And I read Dare Me, and I liked it, but I didn't love it. Megan's writing is like, it's a very acquired taste. It's like very flowery and beautiful and painstakingly constructed. And I am very much a bare bones, images driven, put on the page what you need on the page. And I tend to gravitate towards that in my reading. So when The Turnout came out, I was like, oh, you know, I really liked her. And when you work with her, we really liked her. So like, I'll buy it as if she needs the rub from me. She's like an incredible, incredible bestseller. But I just fell in love with it. And it was the sort of first 10, 20 pages. I was like, I don't know. It's a lot of similes. There's a lot of strange sentence structure that makes it quite lyrical. Mm. I was like, I'm struggling. And then within 10, 20 pages, I could not put it down. So The Turnout for sure. And Kazuo Ishiguro's most recent one, because I love him.
That Clara and the Sun.
Clara and the Sun. Let's not, because I mean, you know, need another hour. Like, I'm obsessed with him. I'm obsessed with his themes. Like, the futility of love in Kazuo Ishiguro would be my non-existent PhD paper. Like, well, Never Let Me Go is one of my absolute all-time favorite books. The thing with Clara and the Sun, it was that thing where I'm scared to read it, because what if I don't like it? Because I didn't love The Buried Giant. And I was like, what if I don't love it? And then I'm going to be devastated. And we're still in lockdown. I'm like, I can't do this. But I did love it, and everything was okay.
Hooray!
I'm sure ending. He's pleased to know that we came good in the end.
He was waiting. But what does Lindsay Kelce think?
Literally, I'm sure at home checking his emails.
Huge, huge thanks to Lindsay. On a Night Like This is published by HarperCollins, and it's out now. And honestly, when the world seems grey and bleak and wintry, I cannot think of a better cure for the clock's gone back blues. You can follow us at YBooked on social media. Look out for book recommendations, words of wisdom from old guests, and occasional shelfies. We love it when you share the podcast with your friends, and thank you so much to everyone who's left us a 5-star review. It helps other people to discover us and their favourite new book. You can find a list of all the books mentioned by Lindsay at acast.com/booked and check out her selection in our bookshop on bookshop.org. We'll be back next week. For now, I leave you with this from P.G. Woodhouse. I always advise people never to give advice. See you next time. Thank you.